Thank you all for coming to Feminism 101. This is part of the Inspiring Women Among Us event, which is 11 now jam-packed days of over 43 events going on, way too many in some ways, but part of the problem is everybody got very excited and started shoving stuff in, so lots of opportunities. I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge that we are standing upon the territory of the Clayton Dene Nation, which never ceded the territory, but is kind enough to welcome UNBC into the area. And also to acknowledge the sponsors for the Inspiring Women Among Us event, who are many, SHRC, Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, UNBC, the City of Prince George, Association of Professional Engineers and Geoscientists. So we've been very fortunate in terms of sponsorship. We have a number of very exciting events that I would just like to draw your attention to today before introducing our speaker today. At 12 o'clock, we have the Flavors of Indigenous Marginalization and Aboriginal Education in Canada. Speaker Anne Gogluska from Queen's University will be talking about pedagogy and how we incorporate Indigenous perspectives, or don't, as the case may be. And that is in room 5175. We also have, which is very exciting, the NRESI Lecture, Gender and Participation at the COP21. Claire Martin, who probably is best known as the weather person, but has worked for Environment Canada and was Canada's delegate to the Paris Climate Change Talks, will be talking about what it's like to be a woman in the midst of a testosterone-laden climate change atmosphere. She's a just had breakfast with her, very feisty woman. It's going to be a really great talk. And then at 7 p.m. tonight in the Canfor Theater, we'll be debuting the film She's Beautiful When She's Angry, which is a film of the rise of the women's movement in North America. And given the events of last week, I think we all need to remember where we've come from. So I would like to very much thank Michelle Connolly, who is currently the coordinator for the North of the Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions, who has so very kindly agreed to do an introduction to Feminism 101 for us. I think when we talk about inspiring women, we need to talk about what brings us together. Feminism is one of those things that, as I teach university students, I say, well, I support women, but I'm not a feminist. And I think it's because we don't understand what feminism is, can be, where it's going, that causes us to want to not label ourselves as feminists. So we really appreciate the opportunity to understand what feminism can. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, Annie. I don't have a microphone on. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yep.
So I've got a picture of a forest in this slide because this is my natural habitat. I have a master's of science in forest ecology. But I'm not an academic or a scholar. I'm a staff person here at the university. So why am I talking about feminism? Well, I've been interested in social movements for most of my life. And secondly, I'm a female who's lived my entire life in Western civilization or Western culture, which is patriarchy, and I've never known anything different. And it was only really recently that I even discovered that there was such thing as a matrilineal society or a matriarchy. So today I want to talk about some things that I wish I had known as a younger person. So before I start, I want to recognize the Women's Studies Department here. I would encourage everyone to take a course in Women's Studies. So Take Back the Night is an annual march to end violence against women. And I attended the one here in September in Prince George. And I'm going to play a short clip, and I want you guys to tell me what it is that these women are chanting.
Patriarchy's got to go!
Patriarchy's gotta go. So if patriarchy has to go, it would help us to know where it came from, how it came to be, and that's what I'm going to start off with. So this is the outline for my talk. I'm going to talk about patriarchy, and I'm going to talk about women's response to patriarchy, so a brief history of the women's movement. I'm going to talk about three tools that the patriarchy uses to keep us in our place: gender, pornography, and prostitution. And then I'm going to talk about what I think feminism should look like now. I'm going to start with patriarchy. This is the definition of patriarchy. So it literally means the rule of the father, and it's used more generally now to refer to male domination, to the power relationships by which men dominate women, and to characterize a system whereby women are kept subordinate in a number of ways. Last spring, I came across this article in an online newspaper I sometimes read, and the title caught my eye. It said, "Early men and women were equal, say scientists." And the authors of the paper that this article was on found that modern hunter-gatherer societies, equality between the sexes is the norm. And they argue that agriculture is what caused the shift to inequality between men and women. And they claim that agriculture led to three things. So it led to the accumulation of resources, the rise of systems of property, and the inheritance of wealth. And after doing a bit more reading, I discovered that they were not the first people to say this. A historian named Gerda Lerner wrote a book in 1986 called The Creation of Patriarchy. And in her book, she looks to uncover the roots of patriarchy and understand the process whereby it became entrenched. And as the title of her book suggests, she considers patriarchy to be an artifact of civilization, and by civilization I mean agriculture. So she says male dominance arose out of a biologically determined situation, i.e. the fact that women are the ones that bear children, and became a culturally created and enforced structure over time. And what I love about this, she says, patriarchy has a beginning in history, and if that is so, it can be ended by historical process. Amanda Foreman is another historian, and a couple years ago she made a documentary on the BBC called The Ascent of Woman, and I recommend watching the first episode at least. It's free on YouTube. And like the researchers in the Science article and Gerda Lerner, she asserts that human societies haven't always been patriarchal. So she asks the question, how far back do we have to go to find an alternative story? So the next few slides are about some information I learned from this documentary. So this is Chanelhoyuk. Has anyone ever heard of this place before? Manny has. So it's one of the first known settlements in human history, and it was inhabited from 7500 before Christ, BC, at the tail end of the Stone Age. And its early inhabitants lived at right at the beginning of agriculture. So they were just learning to sow crops, and they had semi-domesticated animals. So archaeologists looked at DNA, they looked at wear and tear on bones, and they looked at soot in the lungs of the things that they found there. And they discovered that this society at Chanelhoyuk was egalitarian. There was no hierarchy of dominant class. Men and women ate the same diet. There was little sex division of labor, so little division of labor between males and females. And there was no evidence of warfare for a really long period. But these are some Muslim women holding a picture of a figurine called the Seated Woman of Chanelhoyuk. And Amanda Foreman points out that we'll never really know what this figurine meant to the people of Chanelhoyuk. But she echoes what we heard earlier, which is that in early civilization there was no blueprint for inequality between men and women. So I want to situate this story in time for a sec. This timeline shows our Stone Age ancestors, so this is 2.6 million years ago. Humans that look like us first appeared about 200,000 years ago. And Chanelhoyuk kind of falls around where that orange part is, the beginning of the orange part. And modern humans are at the red dawn at the end. So if you accept that patriarchy arose with agricultural civilization, it means that for most of our existence as humans, we've been free of this system called patriarchy. So in the millennia that followed, women's roles became tied to the home, and their status became secondary to men, who took control over property in public space. And those things actually became enshrined in law. So these are the earliest known law codes. The cones in the middle here, one of the lines on there reads, "If a woman speaks out of turn, then her teeth will be smashed by a rock." The black one, if you're wondering who it serves, the shape of it should give you a big clue. The black one basically legalized patriarchy by giving men power over women's bodies. So it gave husbands and fathers the right of ownership of the sexual reproduction of wives and daughters. And women could be put to death for adultery, for instance. The Assyrian laws are on the upper right, and fully half of them deal with marriage and sex. and they enshrine double standards between men and women. So men could do whatever they want to their wives. They could pull their hair and twist their ears, it says. And women would be executed for abortion, for example. Another detail about this one, it says that if a man rapes someone, his wife will be raped in punishment. The rapist's wife will be raped in punishment for him raping someone else. Amanda Foreman points out that the art produced by civilization, so agricultural societies, tells us a lot about the culture. And this is a picture of people killing a lion. So art from the Assyrian period is a lot about male virility, militarism, and domination of nature, like this one shows. So I'm going to jump ahead a few millennia here and describe women's resistance to patriarchy after colonization in a place that we refer to as Canada. So sometimes people refer to waves of feminism, and other people feel like the movements should be seen as continuous. I'm not going to go into the kind of detail that this section deserves, though, so I really suggest people look into it a bit more. So Indigenous women, like Nana Benique, were early campaigners for women's rights when it came to property. She is a woman whose land was taken away from her, she's Ojibwa, when she married a non-Indigenous man. And she wasn't allowed to buy it back, according to the rules of the time. So she actually took a boat all the way across the Atlantic to visit Queen Victoria and demand that she get her land back, and she was allowed to buy it back. So women's suffrage is the right of women to vote in political elections and the right to run for public office. And suffrage campaigns often called for improved public health, equality and employment in education, social assistance, and the condemnation of violence. Yeah.
I just would like to know, I've heard the suffrage used so much. What is the definition of suffrage?
So it was new to me when I learned about it too. I never really understood what it was. And it means the right of women to vote in political elections and the right for them to run in public office to be elected for political positions of power.
So I get stuck at suffering, so I...
I know, it sounds like suffering. I think it's supposed to mean something like franchise. That's the other word that means suffrage. So some suffragists, these women that fought for women's rights, took up the cause of women workers who were, for the most part, poorly paid and they were unprotected. So after Confederation, so 1867 onwards, legal and property rights were a continuing focus of a few generations of Canadian women. The picture on the right is a woman named Marianne Shad. She was a suffragist and a slavery abolitionist. She was a black woman, and she was one of the first published. She was the first female publisher in Canada. But she was marginalized because of her race. Most Canadian suffragists were of European origin. Some of them were sympathetic to Indigenous women, but for the most part, they didn't campaign for the rights of First Nation or Inuit in legislation. So women of European descent in Canada could vote in 1917, and Indigenous women were not able to vote until 1960. So feminist activism of the 1960s and 70s was about giving women control over their own bodies and resisting male violence against women. The abortion caravan of 1970 was the first national action of the women's movement in Canada. Don Hemingway was one of the leaders of the abortion caravan. She's right here.
That's not legal. This stuff in New York.
And you've got a booklet of media articles from that time.
I do. I should have brought it. It's up in my office.
It's in your office. Yeah. Well, you guys should go ask for it because some of the articles are really fascinating and the headlines are hilarious because they're written by men. So they set off from Vancouver to get to Ottawa for Mother's Day. And they stopped in communities along the way for meetings, rallies, and protests. And they got tons of media, like I said. And it's worth pointing out that no social movement since the 1930s had planned something on a national scale the way these women did. So this era also brought the creation of rape crisis centers. So Vancouver Rape Relief and Shelter, or the SOS Center here in Prince George, for example. And before this era, there was nowhere in Canada where women could turn if they were sexually assaulted. Another important thing to come from second wave feminism is the creation of women-only spaces, like the Northern Women's Center that we have here and we have at other universities as well. And one of the interesting things I learned from this book is that one of the things that distinguished the Canadian feminist movement in the 60s and 70s was that in Canada, socialist feminism was really prominent, and in the States, it wasn't. So books like this one by Kate Millett made feminist ideology available to a wider audience, and there are other key e-books as well. And one cool thing that I learned was that in 1973, there was federal funding available for women's groups doing advocacy, and there were also tons of magazines and newspapers all over the place. Feminist ones. So in the 90s, feminists introduced the concept, an important concept called intersectionality, which is a way of explaining interacting forms of oppression faced by women based on race, class, and sexuality. And a popular form of third wave feminism is the notion that individual and personal choices equate to something they call empowerment. So next I'm going to talk about the tools that patriarchy uses to keep us in our place as females. So we're going to play a word association game. When you guys see the word masculine, what other words come to mind?
Muscle.
Just yell them out. Masculine.
Penis.
Aggressive. Any more?
Penis.
More? How about these ones? When you hear the word feminine, what words come to mind?
Frilly.
Frilly. Dainty.
Dainty, frivolous.
Nice.
Submissive.
Nice.
Nice. Yeah. Words like this, feminine, pretty, frivolous, emotional, irrational. So this is gender. And it's arranged this way on the screen because it's a hierarchy, with masculinity being on the top and femininity being on the bottom. And a metaphor that's commonly used to describe gender is a straitjacket or pink and blue boxes. So let's contrast gender with the thing it's most often confused with, which is sex. So sex refers to the biological and physiological characteristics that define men and women, and gender refers to the socially constructed roles, behaviors, activities, and attributes that a given society considers appropriate for men and women. That's according to the World Health Organization. So put another way, sex refers to biological differences, chromosomes, hormonal profiles, internal and external sex organs, and gender describes the characteristics that a society or culture delineates as masculine or feminine. So in other words, sex is male or female, and gender is masculine or feminine. So these two words are often conflated and or confused because sex can mean something different. It also means the act of sex as well as the biological definition. And gender is sometimes used to mean the perception of someone's sex, but those are the real definitions. So some people believe that gender is innate or something you're born with, but feminists, like me, believe that gender is constructed as opposed to natural. So gender fuses biological sex and personality together, and feminists believe that in doing so, it's oppressive. So feminists don't believe in pink or blue brains because it means pinning one behavioral trait against one sex or the other. And most of us already know this, but if you needed scientific evidence for this, this paper came out last year, and it said they did an examination of brains, and they said that although there are sex and gender differences in brain structure, brains do not fall into two classes. Each brain is a unique mosaic of features. So unfortunately, in the patriarchal culture we live in, females are socialized into gender from birth, and it means that girls and boys grow up believing that there's a right or a wrong way to be a girl or a boy. So male babies are socialized into masculinity, into the dominant class, and female babies are socialized into femininity, so the subordinate class. This is something, so it results in this kind of crap. This is part of the socialization of girls and boys. And smart women already know this. So Nora Dean Knight says, there is no set of feelings that are only allocated to women and another set for men. Megan Murphy says, one has to ask how progressive it is to accept the notion that gender is a thing that one can be born with, as it is precisely the tactic used historically by men to defend the idea that women should not be able to vote, work outside the home, or hold positions of power in society. Sarah Dighton says that the qualities of femininity are not inherent properties of female humans, but ones that female humans are socialized to develop, maintaining them in inferiority to men. So gender naturalizes sex stereotypes and sex-appropriate behaviors. Rachel Ivey at the bottom says, without patriarchy, there'd be no need for gender. And finally, Bronwyn Winter says, sex is biological and gender is ideological. So how does gender function in our Western society? Well, in addition to keeping people in boxes, it also punishes people who fall outside of these boxes. Corrective rape is something that happens to lesbians because they're not interested in men, so they're a threat to the heterosexual order. Harassment of men who are not masculine, males who are gay, also are offend the gendered order of hierarchical dominance. This is what women's labor liberation front says. So to end this section on gender, I'm going to quote a woman named Alison Gray. She says that girls are taught throughout their life to be quiet, be small, be stupid, and be polite. We are taught to constantly monitor, modify, and mute ourselves. And what's scarier is that these things are seen as sexy. So with that, I'm going to talk about the second tool of the patriarchy, which is pornography. Lear Keith says that patriarchy eroticizes domination and subordination and sexualizes acts of oppression. So this is actually advertising. It's not pornography necessarily, but it's really hard to tell the two apart, almost always. Gail Dines is a scholar, and she did a TED Talk last year called Growing Up in a Pornified Culture, and I would really suggest watching it. She's very interesting. And she has a lot to say about what growing up in a pornified culture is. So she says, teenage girls are being taught to hypersexualize and pornify themselves. Think about what it means to be male and grow up in a culture where before you can even speak, females are offering themselves to you, come get me, come get me. And she's referring to images like the one on the upper right, which you see every time you go to Save-On in the magazine section, basically. So she says, girls learn that they have two choices, fuckability or invisibility. This is a woman whose blog I sometimes visit, and she wrote this. She talks about how girls nowadays are being trained to feed the male gaze. So she has a picture of herself when she was 14 on the right, and then she has a picture of a 14-year-old girl nowadays. So porn sites get more visitors each month than Netflix, Amazon, and Twitter combined. This is from Yale Science's presentation. And some researchers did a study of pornographic movies, and they said that 90% of them contained at least one aggressive act if both physical and verbal aggression were combined. And Gail Dines cites 40 years of research. I'm sorry, I don't have the reference for this. It's in her talk. And all that research shows that porn use limits capacity for intimacy, and increases the likelihood of sexual assault, and it decreases empathy for rape victims. And Megan Murphy on Feminist Current explains the link between pornography and entitlement. She explains that the link between pornography and rape is entitlement. She says that rapists and porn consumers are not as different as they'd like to believe. Men who use porn show the same sense of entitlement to sex and to women's bodies that rapists do. And this link was made upsettingly clear to me a few months ago when I read a story from Feminist Current about a woman in a small village in India who was raped at night by a gang of men, and they filmed it and then circulated the video on something called WhatsApp. And so the film was circulated to all the men in her village. And she went to talk to her doctor about it, and her doctor said, it's your fault. And she went to talk to the authorities in the village, and they said, yeah, it's your fault. So she took poison a few days later, and she died. So these types of videos, in this place and in other places, are sold in local shops. And when the media interviewed one of the shopkeepers that sold these videos, he said that porn is passé, these real-life crimes are all the rage. So I'd like to quote Gail Dines again. She said that the pornographers did a kind of stealth attack on our culture, hijacking our sexuality, and then selling it back to us, often in forms that look very little like sex, but a lot like cruelty. The only solution to this is a movement that is fierce in its critique of sexual exploitation and steadfast in its determination to fight for what is rightfully ours. So I'd like to finish off this section with a heartwarming story.
Thank you.
This happened in 1982 in Vancouver. There's a chain of three pornographic video stores called Red Hot Video. And they carried material that showed women being violently treated, and apparently also carried videos of women being murdered called snuff films. So women's groups in Vancouver did a public education campaign, and they used picketing and leafleting. And they even wrote the BC Attorney General to argue that the stores violated hate crime laws. But they got nowhere with this. They asked the Attorney General to shut the stores down, but they got nowhere. So they decided to take matters into their own hands, and they formed a group called the Women's Fire Brigade. And early one morning in November, they Molotoved two of the porn stores, blew them up, and burnt them to the ground. No one was inside, thankfully. So before these stores were burned down, Lee Lakeman is an activist who was one of the early founders of Women's Rape Relief and Shelter in Vancouver, and I listened to a radio interview, and she said that she had to walk by one of these stores every day on her way to the Rape Relief Center. And she points out that violent pornography is available everywhere now on the internet, and it's a real harm to real women. So the third tool of the patriarchy is prostitution. Back in 2014, Justin Trudeau stated that prostitution itself is a form of violence against women, and I agree with that statement. And when he became our prime minister, Free Feminists wanted to make sure that Bill C-36, which is called the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act, which was passed by the previous government, was effective in protecting women, helping marginalized women. So this past summer, Trisha Bapty on the left, she's a former prostitution survivor, Megan Murphy, who writes for Feminist Current, and Cherry Smiley, who's with Indigenous Women Against the Sex Industry, wrote a letter to Prime Minister Trudeau and the Minister of Justice, explaining that their support for Bill C-36 was rooted in an understanding of the sex industry as an extension of Canada's colonial legacy, as well as a system that sees women and girls, particularly marginalized women and girls, as disposable and consumable objects. And in their letter, the women asked this stark question: what does allowing men to purchase and sell women to exploit the inequalities of the most marginalized say about us as a culture? I would really like to ask Amnesty International this question, because last year they adopted a policy to fully decriminalize the sex industry, as in pimps and johns. So effectively declaring that from their point of view, women were legal commodities for sex. But thankfully, the backlash was swift. This person made like a fake Amnesty thing that says Amnesty International defending pimps everywhere, Impunity International protecting the rights of pimps and sex buyers, and this is my favorite, Amnesty International, protect male entitlement to a prostituted class. Women in the UK took to the streets about it. Elizabeth Pickett points out that Amnesty International, like many of the groups formed by sex workers, pimps, and johns, has based this decision on an idealist, liberal, capitalist notion of autonomy, individual freedom, including freedom of contract, freedom from coercion, duress, and undue influence, it simply does not apply to the oppressed and exploited people of the world, never mind women. So in other words, these women don't have free choice. They're in prostitution for a lack of choice. And this person points out, the first premise of decriminalization is men's alleged right to buy women's bodies. Cherry Smiley from the Indigenous Women Against Prostitution points out that prostitution is whitewashed and sanitized as sex work, leaving women to deal with the consequences. She says that racist, sexist, and capitalist inequalities funnel women and girls into prostitution. If you're at all curious about what an entitled male who doesn't get it looks like, this is Kenneth Roth. He is the director of Human Rights Watch, believe it or not. And he says, all want to end poverty, but in the meantime, why deny poor women the option of voluntary sex work? Well, the response on his Twitter was pretty great. This woman, Rashira Gupta, said, does Human Rights Watch stand for commodification of people, or does it not matter if they are female, poor, and of color? And then a guy posted these two things. He said, do you know what you sound like? Social conditions pushed her to do this. Now she either sells herself to eat or just dies. Voluntary, yeah, right? And he says again, let's push him to do prostitution, to work in prostitution to satisfy men's sexual fantasies, subject them to violence, and then pretend it's voluntary. Okay, so we're going to talk about feminism now. So just to summarize that section, I want to say that we need an organized resistance to all those elements of patriarchy in our own lives and at large. But I'm going to change tack a little bit, and I'm going to talk about what I think feminism should look like now. So what is feminism? So the feminist movement is a political movement that fights towards women's collective liberation and an end to male violence against women. And it's the political practice of fighting male supremacy on behalf of women as a class. These are all recent actions of feminists. You might recognize the one on the upper left. These women are with their signs in front of the hospital because how many of you have seen the pro-life ones in front of the hospital at this time? Yeah, so these women, these stalwarts get together every month or so and hold up their signs. That's Crystal right there. Sarah Boyd from the Women's Center organizes these, thank goodness for them. On the upper right shows a recent, all these are recent actions, by the way, they're all, I think they all happened in the last 6 or 7 months. This was a mass action in Iceland where women left work to protest the wage gap, so they make a lot, even in Iceland they make less money than men do. You always think that the Scandinavian countries are the most progressive. And the lower left, this was an action that happened all across Latin America, apparently. A woman in Argentina got raped and murdered, so people came out in the streets about it. And the lower right, in Poland, legislators tried to ban abortion across the board, and women were not having it, so they had mass protests. So as the IRP points out, and these women all point out, there are no individual solutions to political problems, there are only collective solutions. So I want to conclude by talking about a woman I heard at International Women's Day in March. Her name is Cheryl George, and she went up to speak first at the event that was organized by Shannon Williams here on campus in March. And when she was talking, I felt like I was in a different, I was in some kind of time warp or in a different place, because she was describing that in her culture, she's Wet'suwet'en, she was describing that when she grew up, violence against people and against women was almost unheard of. And she was talking about a system that I had zero familiarity with. So I went to talk to her after that, and she explained to me what a matrilineal society was. She told me that the Wet'suwet'en culture, their territory is their land, which is so important to their culture. It's central to their culture, the health of ecosystems, water bodies, wildlife. The women manage it, and it's passed down matrilineally. They also make the rule codes in their society, and they enforce them. And then it occurred to me that all these cultures across BC, First Nations cultures in general, but also matrilineal cultures, are under attack by industrial projects like pipeline companies and mining, mostly energy companies and pipeline companies. And I realized that I'd always taken it as a given. For me, it was always a foregone conclusion that we should protect the rights of First Nations people to their land. But it became personal. When I heard her tell me about their matrilineal society, I realized that these cultures represent these cultures represent the only hope we have of any other examples of a way to do things. They're non-patriarchal, and so we need to protect them for our own good as non-Indigenous women. It's our responsibility. So to finalize, sorry about this, you guys. I'm losing in part because I have a fancy education, and I went through my whole life, and I didn't even know that there was an alternative out there for how to do things.
It's okay. Emotional feminism.
So to conclude, my advice to Northern feminists is take a First Nations Studies class so that you're not clueless like I was about the alternatives out there to patriarchy. Support the Indigenous Women Land Defenders with all your might, and act collectively. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Where do you think we're going to go after last week?
Oh my god.
See, I told you that, right? Well, the tears will make you just angry.
People are going to fight harder. I remember reading about how the biggest period of civil unrest in the environmental movement, so the environmental movement is the movement on most familiar women, and I remember reading that the early 1980s in the U.S. was the period where there was the most civil disobedience, underground actions, and that kind of thing. And that was because they had an extreme right-wing government, and they were reacting to it. So if anything good can come from this, I think it's that women are going to become more radical.
This isn't really a question, but I just, in terms of the history, I don't know if any people here were able to get to the pre-event that we did on the abortion caravan, but one of the pieces that gets written a lot, and I should say that I came into academia very late in life, I've mostly just been a social activist working, right, so I'm not fully engaged at the time of the abortion caravan. We were organizing, we weren't about writing. And I guess a lot of the literature that was written about that period, I think, was written by people who weren't fully engaged. They were observers. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that often is said is that the question of intersectionality just sort of appeared in the 1990s. And in fact, I just wanted to give just a teeny bit of a flavor of what actually was going on in 1970 in the abortion caravan as an example. And I mean, there were many, many things going on in organizing the women's liberation movement at that time that reflected intersectionality that was coming. And so, for example, I come from a working class family. I didn't have scholarships or a whole bunch of money to go to university. I worked in a hospital. I worked in the hospital kitchen while I was going to school. And so we would be having what we call consciousness-raising sessions that went all through the night. And some of us who came from working-class families were already raising the issue that we can't stay up all night. We have to go to work the next day. Or at the same time, the 60s scoop was happening with Indigenous women, and I was located in the Lower Mainland. We sat and sit-ins with Indigenous women at some of the housing projects in Vancouver who were having their kids taken away. So, and there was a growing movement within the organizations at that time around different gendered approaches to lifestyle. For example, at that time it was mostly women who were lesbian women who had not been able to express that. But also, and I only reflect on it now, there were women as well who were transgendered and didn't know what that was or what was happening to them. So I always feel when I read those things that it's really important that historically things didn't just kind of happen. Those things were happening as we were organizing at that time. And one final example is the van that I drove in across Canada for the abortion caravan. One side, it said, get abortion out of the criminal code. The other side said, smash capitalism. And so that reflects another conversation that was going on. Are we about just reforming, or are we about system change? And so I just always feel like I need to say that, because it really was already, those things were happening. They didn't just kind of, oh, wow, now we have intersectionality. It might be the first time it's written about, but in practice, in life, you know, those and many other things were going on as well. So I just always...
Yeah, that was true in the States.
Yeah.
In the 60s and early 70s. And this is a very bad thing to say, perhaps, but I think where it went very wrong, where you started to see this division of is now race, or women, or... capitalism or environmentalism, because in the 60s and 70s growing up, it was about everything sometimes.
Yeah.
The problem was when the academics got involved, mm-hmm. right? And the moment mm-hmm. we started to see women's studies departments spring up, suddenly it got solidified. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you had to be one thing or the other, and you had to talk about women's issues, but they were very bad about talking it. And this is where the white elitist feminism suddenly came to fruit, because I think everybody who was out there on the front line trying to make things better, we're like, fuck that, let's just help each other. And it was the academic discourse, and let's make it a theory, that turned it into boom, 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 boom. Academic siloing is death for living, breathing movements, I think, and splits things off that really are part of the intersect. I hate that word, but that larger fight that everybody has to deal with.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Dawn. Thanks, Andy, for that. And that's why I said at the beginning that the movement should be considered as a continuum.
Yes,
I read that in a couple places instead of just being separate ones.
I have more of a comment than a question. I lived through the time where I had to learn very quickly, and it was like hitting a cement wall when I had to learn it, to be subservient. Not only subservient to men, I had to learn how to be subservient to another culture. I came flying into my European classroom. I didn't go to residential school. I was hidden. So I went to a secular school, and I had to learn. The very first thing I had to learn is you never ask a white woman her age. And I went, why? What's wrong? And then from there, all of my strength started to crumble. Because I didn't have, as a matriarch, I have been groomed. And when my mom passed away, I am the matriarch. Now, since just before my mom passed away, I had to learn to undo all of that and realize that it had taken on so many wrong meanings or turned meanings of English words, like the definition of humility. In the European world, apparently it means weakness. And in our culture, the most strongest, the most powerful woman would be the humble woman that hears all and sees all. And you have to be really humble to do that. And I had to unlearn all of that. The most difficult thing in my life and my head was this spinning, because why did God teach me these things? And now it's all wrong. It's all wrong. And now I've got to learn how to do the maypole dance and the Highland Fling. And nobody would explain to me, why do I have to learn those things? I already know how to dance. And when I dance, I'm praying. I don't do it for performance. I have to relearn everything and unlearn everything. And it didn't come through until we made the masks, when I realized, I almost sold out. I almost gave up. And it was the hardest thing to come to this. But I'm determined to stand back up again. I'm determined that we are going to go back the way it was. The way it had to be for us to survive. We didn't kill each other. We didn't violate each other. We couldn't afford to. Because our lives, our children's lives, depended on each other. Our grandchildren's lives, the ones that have not even been spoken of or thought of. Their lives depend on us getting back. And it's so like this. This is possible. I feel it. I see it. And it's hopeful. Now all we've got to do is relax and learn about each other. Not assume about each other, but really learn, really want to learn. Like, how many of you know that drumming was the basis of all of our cultures? And I say that in the schools all the time. I am determined that we all will come together. I challenge you all, research your histories and see what happened while the drums were put away. Because they were just as integral in all of the cultures of the world, and according to the research that I've done, because I couldn't find another area of research that we all had common knowledge. And I know we all had drums. I'm not saying go back to them, but research what happened. And then in that, I believe you will know what happened to us. And the struggle that we had to put forward to hang on to the drum, and why? Why put all that energy into hanging on to the drum? Anyway, I share that for whatever it's worth.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. Can you go back to your slide on male and female, the question that you asked, what do you think of? Please. Is that easy? And to see the reference to bombing, I was a little bit surprised. But I think can you go to that slide again with the two genders?
Boxes?
Boxes, yeah, just before that. If we could blend those and see them both as masculine and feminine, and I'll just use them, maybe just a humorous example is, I mean, we experience it every day, many times a day. Soft can be strong. Mm-hmm. Toilet paper has to be. I mean, it rips apart. And we can be. And men are soft. And they're feminine. And for years, I heard real men don't cry. And it's just simply a fallacy, in the same way that real women don't cry. We cry. It's not gender specific, and it's totally okay. Like, I really appreciated your tears and empathize, because I had them right in my face too. So I think if we learn to be gentle with ourselves, then we'll have a strong point perspective on how to be gentle with each other. I mean, we're all here on this planet as human beings, as equals. And we have the intelligence to, I think the only thing that separates us from the wings and the four-leggeds and the finned is that we can choose to be compassionate or otherwise. And I'd really prefer that we choose to be compassionate more than otherwise.
I just have to say one more thing. This is where I started really getting flashbacks, because I only knew the top. I had to learn the bottom. And that's when I said, holy shit, what happened to me when I saw that? And my theory is that if all of this can be topsy-turvy in one human being, in one lifetime, we can still do it. It's possible.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.